The Imperial Bank of Persia. Even by the 1880s, the Reuter concession entanglement had still not gone away. The persistent financier pushed the British Foreign Office and pulled strings at home in the hope of being compensated for his cancelled concession. For 15 years, his pleas to the British government had only served to block Iran from granting concessions to any other agent for the construction of railroads or other projects. This was a mixed blessing, for although it discouraged economic and financial dependence on European interests, as, for example, happened in Egypt and the neighbouring Ottoman Empire, it also hindered capital investment and slowed Iran's economic and human development. Yet it is important to note that the construction of railroads, despite the high hopes in this enterprise, failed to play a key role in the industrialization of the Middle East. It did, however, increase the mobility of the population, as well as of foreign goods and the export of cash crops. Even in the Pahlavi era, construction of the Trans-Iranian Railroad did not result in any industrial miracle. If no major railroad project was ever undertaken in Iran before 1928, there was discussion, negotiation, and preliminary schemes throughout the 1880s and beyond. The building of a railway, the favourite pastime topic of discussion of the Shah and his advisers, was often aborted by concerns over rival European powers and lack of capital. And although there was no railroad, Qajar, Iran did have a 5.5-mile narrow-gauge tramway built by a Belgian firm to ease Tehran's pilgrimage traffic to the nearby Shah Abd al-Azim shrine south of the capital. Opened in 1887, this pride of Qajar modernity, called Chemin de Fer, but soon to be known by the public as Machine Doudi, smoke machine, remained in service until 1961, a relic of the Qajar desire for progress and a sad remark on the dictates of geopolitics. In 1888, the appointment of the flamboyant English envoy Sir Henry Drummond Wolfe dramatically shifted the situation in favour of greater British economic involvement in Iran. Wolfe was the son of an eccentric convert to Protestantism, Joseph Wolfe, who in the 1820s had travelled to Iran and Central Asia as a missionary in search of the lost tribes of Israel. Before coming to Iran, Henry Drummond Wolfe had served as a diplomat in Egypt and later as a British Member of Parliament. He nurtured strong ties with the London financial community, including the Rothschilds, the Sassoons, and Julius Reuter. He was a vocal advocate of British economic investment abroad and of the use of capital finance to leverage British imperial supremacy. A friend of Lord Randolph Churchill and Arthur Balfour, and a founding member of the influential conservative Primrose League, with its quasi-Masonic hierarchy, Wolfe shared his vision of economic expansionism with Lord Salisbury and, in many respects, foreshadowed George Curzon. He listened to Julius Reuter and found in his repealed concession the potential for opening Iran to British venture capital as an arm of imperial diplomacy. Already in 1887, after a decade of hard negotiation, Nasiruddin Shah had been pressured by the British Foreign Office to open up the Karun River, Iran's only navigable waterway, to international shipping between the Persian Gulf and to Shushtar, in central Khuzestan, and from there over a new carriage road through Bakhtiari land to Isfahan. Learning his lesson from the Reuter episode, Nasiruddin and his government were cautious in drafting the terms of this concession so as to avoid a British monopoly. They strictly regulated the shipping companies in doing business, purchasing property, and collaborating with their Iranian counterparts. Having in mind the fate of the Suez Canal and the British occupation of Egypt some 6 years earlier, the Shah was adamant that he would not be remembered as the prey of British capitalism. In the following decade, the Karun navigation thrived as British and Iranian shipping companies competed for cargo and passengers, hence supporting the local labour market. The privately owned English company, Lynch Brothers, with years of operation along the Tigris and Euphrates, was engaged in healthy competition with a number of European and Iranian companies, of which the most successful, the Nasiri Navigation Company, was run by the Iranian government. The volume of trade in the Karun region increased nearly 17-fold between 1891 and 1902, and the building of the Bakhtiari Road anticipated even larger economic advances after the first production of Khuzestan oil in 1908. Wolfe brought with him a number of proposals, plans, and potential concessions for development. Chief among them, and as it turned out the most successful, was renegotiating the Reuter concession, now a valuable instrument of British diplomacy. If a railroad was not strategically feasible, there were other projects to pursue. Establishing a modern bank seemed the most tangible and more in line with the spirit of European capital investment. The Imperial Bank of Persia, Bank-e-Shahi-e-Iran, established in 1889, took over the operations of the existing Oriental Bank, which had been active since 1885. The concession allowed for the first time branches to be established all over the country and to be engaged in all aspects of modern banking and finances, except mortgage loans for the purchase of property. Most remarkably, the government of Iran granted the bank the exclusive right to issue currency banknotes, a new development in Iran, as until then, currency had been exclusively coins. For the remainder of the Reuter concession, the Imperial Bank in effect gained control not only over the volume of the money in the Iranian market, but also over Iran's finances and monetary policy. It also reserved, once again, the right to exploit Iran's unexplored mineral resources as collateral for the success of the bank operation. The Imperial Bank relied on a cadre of colonial bankers and employees brought from Egypt and elsewhere to quickly start operations, first in Tehran and soon after in major commercial centres in Iran and abroad. The issue of public shares on the London Stock Exchange raised the initial capital of £6 million, $29,210,000. This hefty sum, by Iranian standards, dwarfed the volume of funds available to the private bankers in the bazaar, Sarafs, and posed immediate challenges to the usurers. As the bank began lending, the outrageous interest rates in the bazaar dropped sharply, and the bank's modern operations soon supplanted the arcane practices of local competitors in many areas. Most notably, the long-distance transfer of money for domestic and foreign trade and other financial transactions was substantially eased, as bank transfers and commercial credit gradually replaced the old Bharat money orders. The bank's greatest advantage was its monopoly on issuing banknotes, which, despite some initial resistance, was quickly accepted as the preferred medium of transaction over the cumbersome and unreliable silver and copper coins that had long plagued the Iranian economy. The issue of banknotes of various values was a clear sign of a centralizing monetary system. While the Shah's government had a limited say in the volume and issue of the new currency, the appearance of the Shah's portrait on the banknotes was a symbol of his sovereignty. This proved a mixed blessing for the Iranian government, which in the following years was associated even more closely with financial downturns. The reversals of fortune were not limited to the merchants, who declared bankruptcy because of mismanagement, or vacillations in the worldwide markets, or the bank's manipulations. The state and the Imperial Bank were blamed for market fluctuations. In 1895, for instance, the British legation's newswriter in Shiraz reported that a leading merchant in the city in the opium export trade, Mirza Agha Shirazi, declared bankruptcy, with debts amounting to 400,000 tumans, about $1 million, of which about 90,000 tumans were owed to the Imperial Bank of Persia. He wished to pay back his debts, provided that the amount of 80,000 tumans that he had already paid to the bank as interest be deducted. Reaching a deadlock, the merchant subsequently took sanctuary, Bast, in Shiraz's new mosque. Even a visit by the bank's vice director and pressure from the provincial government, which had cut off the supply of water and food to the mosque, did not persuade him to come out. Eventually, under the Prime Minister's direct instruction, Mirza Agha accepted the arbitration of the Imam Jameh, the chief religious officer of Shiraz and a prestigious mujtahid of the city. Not only did Mirza Agha have to plead to the Imam Jameh for arbitration, but also to the powerful chief of the Kashgai tribe of Fars, who was indebted to the bank to the tune of 73,000 tumans. To pay off his debt on a 7-year arrangement, the Khan settled by mortgaging a number of his villages in the Kashgai land to the bank. By the 1890s, a mortgage bank funded by Russian capital and backed by the Russian legation in Tehran cornered another financial market, making loans to the Iranian elite for their purchase of properties and other oft unsuccessful enterprises. The riches of many of the nobility were lost to this bank, squandered on luxury goods, ostentatious mansions, horses, carriages, and travel abroad. Yet the Russian bank never came close to the breadth of the Imperial Bank's activities. As the sphere of activities of these foreign banks grew, so did the dependency of the merchants and notables on these institutions. Banks operated within a regulated framework, very different from the flexible bazaar finances to which the Iranian merchants were accustomed. As the high-ranking mojtehids heads became more involved in economic affairs of the community, they became more critical of the government and its foreign associates. The tobacco protest and rise of clerical influence. By the late 1880s, the Qajar state began to experience fresh financial pressures caused by worldwide inflation and the collapse of silver-based currencies. The growth of the state and the increasing royal and ministerial appetite for luxury and good living also demanded new sources of income, which could not be secured through agrarian and other traditional taxation. Even the increasing sale of crown lands to private ownership, mostly to influential merchants and the wealthy ulama, and farming out of the custom houses to domestic agents, could not meet the state's needs. To Nasser al-Din Shah and his advisers, the sale of concessions seemed the easiest and most efficient option, and imposing a monopoly on tobacco seemed the most promising. The politics of the late Nasseri era also paved the way for greater foreign presence. Coinciding with the Karun River concession, in 1888, the British government bestowed the highly coveted decoration of the Star of India on the pro-British prince Massad Mirza Zell al-Sultan, 1849-1922, the Shah's powerful senior son and the semi-autonomous governor of Isfahan and a number of central and western provinces of Iran. The decoration was in return for the prince's friendship to the British government, and especially his services toward the conclusion of the Karun concession, and in hopes of further concessions and greater British influence in the south. Whether a premeditated move or out of fear for Zell al-Sultan's pro-British bent, the Shah almost immediately dismissed the prince from all his posts except the governorship of Isfahan. The move orchestrated by the Shah's shrewd new premier, Ali Asghar Khan Amin al-Sultan, 1858-1907, was meant to curb Zell al-Sultan's unchecked ambition and to direct Britain's attention solely to Tehran. Amin al-Sultan, son of the Shah's butler, who was of Georgian slave origin, started his service as a page boy in the Shah's private quarters, Khalvat, and moved his way up, first to the court and then to the divan. After the demise of Mashir al-Dole, he emerged as a partner in power with the chief government accountant, Mirza Yusuf Ashtiani, better known as Mustafi al-Mamalek, chief state accountant of the empire, the shrewd leader of the government's conservative camp, and a man who had served in his hereditary post since the mid-1840s. Known merely as His Excellency, Jenabe Haga, Mustafi had enough skeletons in his closet to make even the Shah deferential toward him and mindful of his intrigues. His death in 1890, however, opened the way for Amin al-Sultan, as the new Sadr-e-Azam, to push for greater accession to foreign capital and expertise. A cunning confidant of the Shah and a master of real politic, more in the style of Agassi and Nuri than Amir Kabir and Mashir ad-Dawla, he symbolized the eventual triumph of the Nasseri courtiers over the Divan class. With no grand vision for overhauling the Divan, and no illusions of steering an independent course in foreign policy, he had vacillated between the Russian and the British embassies in search of the best deal for his royal master and himself. Struggling for survival in the age of empires, he came to share with the Shah a progressively cynical attitude toward government. With the prime ministerial landscape littered with dead and disgraced predecessors, to what else could he aspire other than pleasing the Shah and persuading him to comply with his schemes? The relationship between the Shah and his last premier turned increasingly complex and mutually exploitative. The Shah and Amin al-Sultan, who had earlier decided against a plan to impose a state monopoly on the production of tobacco, later entered into negotiations with a British concessionaire. By 1889, during the royal visit to Europe as a guest of the British government, the Shah finalized the granting of a monopoly on Iranian tobacco to a certain Major G.F. Talbot, then probably the largest grower and exporter of tobacco in the Middle East. Iran exported largely to the Ottoman Empire and supplied its own growing domestic market. The Reji monopoly, as the company came to be known, after an earlier tobacco monopoly granted to it by the Ottomans, was given a 50-year concession for the purchase, distribution, sale and export of all tobacco products throughout Iran. As a major income-earning commodity, tobacco was also vital to Iranian daily life. By the 1890s, as many as 2.5 million people, a good 25% of the Iranian population, both men and women, were regular smokers, mostly in the form of water pipes, galyan, better known today in the West as hookah. Peasants and the poorer classes used long pipes, chopok, and consumed inferior quality tobacco. No other commodity, except perhaps tea, held such sway over the public. Since its introduction in the late 16th century, the production of Iranian tobacco increased all over the country, especially in the provinces of Azerbaijan, Khorasan, Isfahan, and Fars. It is remarkable to note how imprudently the Shah had once again fallen victim to a foreign concession, and for a commodity vital to a large sector of Iranian producers and consumers. It was as though the memories of the ill-fated Reuter concession had all but faded. No doubt, the glamour of the English surroundings, the subtle hints of his British host, and the not-so-subtle persuasions of his chief minister convinced the Shah to go ahead with the concession at the time the ruling elite was ever more oblivious to the public's growing anti-Qajar sentiment. The Shah's hopes for short-term gain had no bounds, even at the expense of the growers and merchants whose sustenance was crucial to the national economy. If the merchants could pocket a substantial profit from the tobacco trade, the Shah must have reasoned, why not him? The royal gain, of course, came at the expense of a large sector of Iranian exporters, wholesalers, distributors, perhaps as many as 5,000, and a much larger body of medium and small-scale tobacco growers. Yet even the hope for a hefty profit was illusory. The Reji concession allocated to the Iranian state no more than a meagre royalty of £15,000, $75,000, and one quarter of annual net profits after deducting expenses. By early 1890, the Reji monopoly had begun to establish a network of provincial offices throughout Iran, manned mostly by colonial bureaucrats, and had started to purchase tobacco from the Iranian growers, soon found, to their dismay, that they had no choice but to sell to the Reji at uncompetitive fixed prices. Yet the main opposition came from the tobacco merchants and their associates. Contrary to the hopes of the Shah and the Reji, eliminating the Iranian middleman and breaking the exporting merchants' hold on the market did not pass uneventfully. Standing to lose their livelihoods, they began to mobilize whatever popular and clerical support they could muster to oppose the monopoly and persuade the state to repeal it. A movement of mass protests between late 1890 and early 1892 successfully challenged both the foreign monopoly and the authority of the Qajar state. This was the first nationwide protest movement, at least since the collapse of the Babi resistance in the 1850s, with popular participation and a pronounced anti-imperialist agenda, a rebellion that anticipated, and in some ways paved the way for the constitutional revolution some 15 years later. The tobacco protest was the first time that the merchants of the bazaar, a number of high-ranking clergy, and a handful of dissidents, found common ground to mobilize the public nationwide and challenge the authority of the Shah. Sporadic protests in the cities began in Shiraz in late 1890 and continued over the course of the next year in Isfahan, Tabriz, Mashhad, and other tobacco-growing centers. In nearly all instances, it was the merchants who pleaded with the local mujtahids to render their support and voice the merchants' grievances. Public gatherings in the mosques denounced the Farangis for their intrusion into the affairs of the Muslims, and, more urgently, for ritually polluting the handling of tobacco. Condemnations such as these were familiar staples of anti-European rhetoric in the Qajar period. Yet the Mojtah heads of influence and wealth were generally reluctant to sever their traditional ties with the state and openly criticized the Shah's initiative, for fear they would make themselves targets of government retaliation. They nevertheless soon realized that they had no choice but to side with the merchants and large-scale growers. The slowing of the flow of religious taxes and dues originating in the bazaar brought the message home. By the beginning of 1891, the Mojtah heads, especially in Isfahan, with the Najafi family at the helm, came to occupy a prominent place in the protest movement. It was Tabriz, however, that witnessed the most serious protests against the monopoly by ordinary men and women. To be sure, there are traces of anti-regime provocation by the Russians in the Tabriz Bazaar. Iran's powerful northern neighbor viewed the regime as a British operation designed to infiltrate Azerbaijan, a province Russia traditionally considered its own backyard. But the thrust of opposition again came from exporting merchants whose very livelihood had been jeopardized. Facing the angry crowd and Russian objections, the Crown Prince Muzaffar ad-Din Mirza, 1853-1907, and his provincial minister, alerted Tehran that unless something was done, they could not guarantee the safety of the province or the regime agents against the gathering revolutionary storm. In response, the regime company, in consultation with the Shah, decided to temporarily cease operations in Azerbaijan. This obvious setback was the first victory for the growing opposition. That a protest movement that had started in the south of the country was fully embraced in the northern commercial center signified a shared economy that surpassed Iran's typical regional polarity. The final act of the anti-regime revolt, however, played out in a dramatic boycott that involved more than the merchants and their allies. In November 1892, a fatwa attributed to Mirza Hassan Shirazi was widely distributed throughout Iran. It called for a ban on smoking tobacco so long as its distribution remained in the hands of the infidels. Even though, as early as 1891, rumours of the ban on smoking were in circulation in Shiraz, it was the name of the chief Mojtah head in the Atabat, the shrine cities of southern Iraq, that gave the legal opinion the necessary weight. Smoking under such circumstances, the fatwa declared, is tantamount to combating the Imam of the age, may God hasten his return. That the fatwa was rumoured to be fabricated by the head of Tehran's merchant guild, Haji Muhammad Kazem Malek al-Tajar, and his associates in the name of Shirazi proved of secondary importance. The ranking Mojtah heads in Isfahan and Tehran, who were in contact via telegraph with Shirazi in the town of Samarra in southern Iraq, made sure that he would approve the fatwa issued in his name. By early 1890s, Shirazi was recognized and referred to as the Marja-e-Taklid, the source of universal emulation throughout the Shi'i world, a position for which he was at least in part indebted to the celebrated advocate of pan-Islamism, Sayyid Jamal ad-Din Asadabadi, better known as Afghani. In a widely circulated letter to Shirazi in 1891, Afghani praised his clerical compatriot as the leader of the Shi'i world and called on him to oppose Nasr ad-Din Shah's despotism, corruption, and selling out to foreign interests. Aside from the Babi anti-Qajar opposition some four decades earlier, this was the first open call in modern Iranian history for the overthrow of the Shah, even though it did not call for the fall of the Qajar dynasty or the monarchy as a whole. Afghani, who earlier had been invited back to his homeland by the Shah shortly before the regime crisis to serve as an advisor to the state, soon came under suspicion for his implicit criticism of the Shah. He received the cold shoulder from the Shah and, shortly thereafter, coinciding with the beginning of the regime protest, was disgracefully dragged out of the shrine of Abd al-Azim, where he had taken sanctuary, Bast, and escorted to the Iraqi border. A renowned dissident, who appeared all his mature life in the guise of a Sunni Afghan and chief advocate of pan-Islamism, Afghani stirred anti-British sentiments from British India to Afghanistan to Istanbul to Egypt. Born in 1839 in the village of Asadabad, 32 miles east of Hamadan in western Iran, a region known for its heterodox Al-Ehaq community, Afghani received some standard Islamic philosophical training before moving to the Shi'i cities of southern Iraq, where, as a seminarian, He was exposed to Sheikhi and Babi ideas. By the 1880s, his magnetic presence had earned him a few devotees in Iran, including Malik al-Tajar and a few Nasiri courtiers and statesmen. Yet, contrary to his popularity in Egypt and India, and admirers such as the celebrated Sheikh Muhammad Abdu, Afghani never earned great support in Iran in his own time. The complexity of his personality, his peripatetic lifestyle, his political versatility, and above all, concealing his Shi'i identity under a Sunni facade, could allow his message to be heard only through insidious channels. Having been humiliated in Iran in 1891, Afghani nursed a deep grudge against the Shah, a resentment that no doubt contributed some years later to Nasiruddin Shah's assassination. His collaboration with former Babis, such as the celebrated writer and intellectual Mirza Aga Khan Kermani, may have influenced Afghani's emphasis on the Shah's illegitimate rule. His plea to Shirazi as the head, Ra'is, and supreme exemplar, Marja et Taqlid, of the Shi'i community, served to propel Shirazi to the forefront of the political struggle. Whether it was Afghani's provocation or the emerging consensus among dissidents and discontent merchants, the tobacco protest had widened the gap between the state and the ulama, and displayed the latter's compliance with the grievances of their mercantile clients. Popular involvement was an unexpected outcome of a protest rooted in deeper economic problems. In Iran, men and women complied with Shirazi's fatwa in public and in private. Water pipes were broken and thrown into the streets, or otherwise stored in back rooms and out of sight. Tobacco retailers shut their businesses, and banners were brought out to demonstrate public solidarity. To the Shah's great annoyance, apparently even women of his own harem refrained from smoking, on the grounds that they followed the Marja-e-Taqlid on religious issues, not the Shah. The public ban, perhaps aggravated by tobacco withdrawal symptoms, demonstrated the power of mass protest and persuaded people to take even bolder steps. Negotiations with Amin al-Sultan, exchanges of telegrams between the Shah and the ulama, and between the mujtahids in the capital and in the provincial centres, added to the sense of urgency. The rebellion was no longer localised or confined to one economic sector, but increasingly gave voice to popular frustrations on a national scale. The pre-revolutionary scene, complete with vigilante enforcement of the smoking ban, appearance of clandestine posters and leaflets known as night letters, and declaring a curfew in the capital, reached its climax in January 1892. The government's threat to expel from the capital the chief mujtahid of Tehran, Mirza Hassan Ashtiani, if he continued to provoke the public and refrain from breaking the smoking ban, backfired. He refused to accept the terms offered by the government. The violent demonstration soon after, following the closure of the bazaar, brought a huge crowd to the Arg Square in front of the Royal Citadel, calling not only for the repeal of the tobacco monopoly, but also for an end to government corruption and the Shah's despotic rule. The crowd showered insults not only on Kamran Mirza, who served as governor of the capital and minister of war, but also on the premier Amin al-Sultan and on the person of the Shah. This was followed by an attempt to break through the gates of the citadel. The armed confrontation with the royal guards and the elite troops who were brought in to defend the royal compound ended in the deaths of 10 demonstrators, with many more injured. The open revolt and clandestine propaganda denouncing the Shah for despotism and corruption, but also chastising the mujtahids for compromise and inaction, were sufficient that both the Shah and the ulama recognized the greater danger, an imminent uprising that threatened the very survival of both institutions. Immediately following the demonstration, the Shah announced the complete repeal of the regime monopoly in the domestic market and for the export of tobacco. The latter issue, nevertheless, remained a matter of dispute with Reji for a long time afterward. The Shah also made sure that the mujtahids who threatened mass migration to Iraq in sympathy with Ashtiani were financially rewarded in the capital and in the provinces. Despite his initial hesitation, Mirza Hassan Shirazi consented to lifting the tobacco ban. Once the Shah was assured of British support, he went along with the terms of the repeal, including payment to the Reji of a cancellation penalty. To do so, the Iranian government was forced for the first time to borrow the necessary sum from the British-controlled Imperial Bank of Persia, £500,000, $2,500,000, with an interest rate of 6% over a 40-year period. Foreign borrowing was a road well trodden by the Egyptian Khedive and the Ottoman Sultan, and in both cases it led to bankruptcy. The Shah and his government, perhaps the Qajar establishment as a whole, however, had a more urgent issue than bankruptcy to worry about. The tobacco protest was able to destabilize the hard-won order of the Nasseri era and ignite a popular protest led by a fragile coalition of merchants, the ulama, and dissidents. In the months and years after the regime, Iran more frequently witnessed expressions of turmoil in the provinces, often with mujtahids at the helm. In Isfahan, a center of Shi'i activism, the notorious Agha Najafi, the doyen of a wealthy and powerful clerical family, who for years had fought a dirty war with Zel al Sultan, prince governor of the city, even declared the advent of an Islamic government on the heels of a declining monarchy. It was as though faith in the Shah as an icon of stability had been shattered. Some 4 years after the end of Reji, on May 1, 1896, Nasiruddin Shah was assassinated on the eve of a jubilee celebrating his 50th lunar year on the Qajar throne, AH 1264-1313. He had gone to the Abdelazim shrine to pay homage to the Shi'i saint and give thanks for his long rule, which had been the longest since the Safavid Tahmasp I. After saying his prayers, he walked freely among the pilgrims, who, contrary to the normal practice of royal visits, were allowed to stay inside the shrine. There he was shot point-blank by Mirza Reza Kermani, a devotee of Jamal ad-Din Afghani. Kermani was an eccentric itinerant dealer in luxury goods and expensive fabrics who harboured a grudge against the Shah's son, Kamran Mirza, for torturing him and subjecting him to years of imprisonment. The bullet that killed the Shah heralded the end of an era, a half a century of relative constancy. The veneer of modernization that covered the Qajar state was just that. The reformist measures by statesmen such as Amir Kabir and Mashar al-Dowle never truly transformed Qajar society. Some features of European material culture came to shape urban space, art and architecture, dress, food and music. The foundations of the state, however, remained largely unchanged. The old Qajar elite were being gradually replaced by a new class of court appointees who were more dependent on the person of the Shah, yet the general conduct of the court and divan remained essentially the same. Nasiruddin's private life and the life of the royal harem also remained unchanged, except that his numerous wives, sisters and concubines became more languid and, with few exceptions, more vain. With age, the Shah's inner court acquired a prurient ambiance, well evident in many entries in the secret diaries of Etemad al-Sultaneh. With a sarcastic eye, he observed changes in the Shah's conduct, the degrading quality of his companions and favourites, his endless daily sorties to the outskirts of the capital to visit royal resorts, pleasure gardens and mountain retreats, and his camping out with a huge retinue around Tehran and elsewhere. He quietly recorded the childish pleasures that punctuated the hideous routine of the court. Among his recurring topics were the Shah's obsessive affection for his favourite page boy, Mali Jack, trivial envies and enmities in the harem and inner court, the Shah's curious taste in dress and appearance, and, above all, his patronizing strategies of favor and fury. After the failure of Herat during the first decade of his rule, Nasiruddin's relations with European powers also remained constant, if not entirely uneventful. The Shah's success in keeping the imperial neighbors at arm's length is one of his notable achievements. European intrusion into economic and commercial spheres seemed inevitable, as had happened with the Reuter concession, the Imperial Bank of Persia, the Karun River concession for a large-scale export of Caspian lumber to a Russian private concern in 1883, and the Reji monopoly. Yet Nasiruddin had been far more successful than his contemporaries. Sultan Abdul Hamid, the Khedives of Egypt, Central Asian Khanates, the Emir of Afghanistan, and the subjugated Rajas of the Indian princely states, in preserving his country's political sovereignty and territorial integrity in the age of colonial expansion. He learned how to turn the terms of the European presumption of Iran as a buffer state to his favour, and how to play the Russian territorial threat in the north against British ambitions in the south and in the Persian Gulf. The 1857 loss of Herat province, a major territorial setback, comparable to the loss of the Caucasus, and minor border compromises to peacefully settle Iran's eastern boundaries, did not minimize the achievements of the Nasseri era. The state's relations with social groups also remained largely unchanged until the last decade of the 19th century, and especially after the tobacco protest, when the tacit state-ulama relationship went through a momentary crisis. The merchants and artisans also began to voice their discontent, as their economic livelihood was further exposed to vacillations in world markets, foreign trade, and foreign concessions. More than ever before, people held the state responsible for its inability to shield the country against such vulnerabilities, for the lack of security in their everyday life, and for weak economic infrastructure. Greater contact with the neighbouring world, Russian-annexed Caucasian and Central Asian provinces, the Ottoman capital and Ottoman provinces such as Iraq and Syria, Egypt under British occupation, and British India, made many émigré Iranians aware of their country's relative underdevelopment, economic disadvantages, and the Iranian government's failure to deal with mounting poverty, health, and social problems. By the last decade of the 19th century, more than a quarter of a million Iranians had emigrated in search of work and a better life to neighbouring cities and regions, especially Baku, Tiflis, Ashgabat, Istanbul, Cairo, Alexandria, Mumbai, and the pilgrimage cities of southern Iraq. The tobacco protest, and later the assassination of the Shah, were symptoms of deeper discontent that first surfaced in makeshift jellygraph posters denouncing the Shah and his government in the exile newspapers such as Qanun, published in London by Malcolm Khan, and smuggled to Iran to clandestine reading groups and discussion circles. Dissent found wider and more organized public expression in the coming years as the Nasseri age gave way to a more relaxed decade under Muzaffar ad-Din Shah, reigned 1896 to 1906. Broader access to the printed word through newspapers and books broadened the intellectual horizons. The nascent press was hardly allowed to criticize the Qajar state and its local agents, but newspapers and translations of Western popular knowledge brought greater awareness of scientific and technological advances, world geography and history, institutions of a modern state, discovery of new lands, and Western colonial advances and economic penetration. The constitutional revolution of 1905 to 1911 signified the rise of a new national community conscious of itself and its deprivations, largely through press and telegraph communication inside Iran and with the outside world.